Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
The director of a great film, a documentary called Born in Chicago, which you just heard clips from and some music from, is John Anderson, who's with us. Good evening, John. Welcome to WGN. How are you?
Good evening, John. It's great to be here. And I'm co-director along with Bob Sarles, who's a San Francisco-based filmmaker.
And how long did it take you to put this together? When did you... I mean, the idea of blues in Chicago has been around, you know, quite a while. And you have this documentary that's going to be screening at the Chicago Blues Fest. What gave you the... You know, what was the spark that you said, okay, you know what, I am going to go after this. I'm going to do a documentary on Born in Chicago Blues. I'm going to go get
it. I knew the story. You know, I knew about Nick Rabinitis and Harvey Mandel and all the names you just heard, Corky Siegel, Barry Goldberg, and who am I leaving out, Bloomfield and Butterfield and Muscle White and Eldon Bishop and Steve Miller, and I think I mentioned Corky. But
yeah,
I knew the story about how those kids who were teenagers and they were musicians had the guts to show up at the West and South Side clubs and were taken under the wings of the original masters. And when I got the gig to shoot a show by Chicago Blues Reunion at Park West in 2008, which features Gravenitis, as I say, Mandel, Siegel, and Goldberg, it was a great show. It was sold out, and there's a DVD I can give you the details on later. But the best part was doing the interviews with these guys and getting into the story. And Barry Goldberg and I made a first cut, and we showed it here in Chicago at a place called Film Row Cinema that's part of Columbia College in probably June of 2010. And it went over well. And then he sent a copy to his buddy, Elliot Roberts, who played it for his client, Neil Young, who loved it, who played it for his buddy, Bob Dylan. I kid you not. Okay, this is when the happy music plays, okay? Because, you know, there's been ups and downs along the way, but this is when... That was enough to give us, you know, when Bob Dylan gave us his approval, we knew we had something. So Barry and I spent the next couple of years traveling the country, shooting the rest of the interviews with Hubert Sumlin and Steve Miller and Marshall Chess and many others. And we thought we had it finished in 2013. It came out back then when it first screened here in town. It was called White, Black, and Blues. And I left it. I had to move on to make a film called Sam Lee and Bluesland, and then another one called Horn from the Heart, the Paul Butterfield story. And though in 2013, when it made its first rounds, it was reviewed favorably in the New York Times and the and Rolling Stone, and showed at Lincoln Center and here at the Siskel Center here in town, and at the Rock and Roll, at the Grammy Museum. And we thought we were on our way. And that was when, okay, now the really happy music plays. All right, it looked great. But then it sort of languished for, I would say, about 4 years. And around 2018, we started gaining some momentum when a filmmaker that I knew named Bob Sarles, who's based in San Francisco, along with his filmmaking partner and wife, Christina Keating, and the author, Joel Selvin, with some support from Shout Factory in California, they did their thing with it and brought it across the finish line. And that's what is showing. And it's what won Best Director at First Glance Philadelphia and Best of Fest in Palm Springs. And they got a nomination for a Circle Award at the DC Film Fest. And yeah, it's going to play this Friday, a week from tomorrow, at the Chicago Blues Festival.
At the Chicago Cultural Center, Claudia Cassidy Theater in Chicago, is that correct?
That's right, 1 o'clock.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're going to show it, and then we're going to have a Q&A afterwards with Barry Goldberg and Bob Sarles and Howlin' Wolf's two daughters, Betty Kelly and Barbara Marks. And it's going to be a great time. I'm sorry to say it's sold out, but I think that there, if you show up, you might be able to get in.
Well, sorry to say it's sold out is, you know, well, I mean,
yeah, it hurts.
Sorry,
it hurts.
I'm sorry there aren't any more seats in there, but the ones that we had, they're all gone. What can I tell you?
Yeah, I'm not sorry for anything. Okay?
No, I know. And that whole, you know, as you were talking, bringing on these names of Bloomfield and Siegel and all of that, and you know, Howlin' Wolf, Buddy Guy, and then I start thinking about, you know, you're talking about these white kids in Chicago growing up, and really relating to the blues, so much so that they ventured forth to find the clubs where they could hear it. And meanwhile, across the pond, as they say, in England, it was having the same effect, as you well know, on people like, well, for instance, the Rolling Stones and to some extent the Beatles. But some of the Stones' early material was just straight-ahead blues, which I believe some of it was recorded at Chess Records here, right here in Chicago. So the idea that they were, I think in their minds, I don't know for sure, but I think the thought process must have been something along the lines of, we're going to go to where it lives, you know what I mean? We're going to go to the source. And so they came here and did that. And I remember reading about it and hearing about them showing up at blues clubs and just getting on stage and jamming. And it's this Chicago blues genre, if you will, obviously has a life of its own, indefinitely, as witnessed here in this film that you have. When is it? Okay, so you're going to screen it. Then what?
Well, back to Marshall Chess. Can I go back to Chess?
No, yeah, you can do whatever you want. You know, please.
Marshall Chess tells the story in the film of the time the phone rang at Chess and his uncle answered and he gave the phone to Marshall and said, talk to these guys. They've got strange accents. I can't understand the word they're saying. So Marshall is talking to Andrew Lou Goldham and gets the gist of it and says, of course, you got to come here. And it was a big deal. You know, it was publicized here in town. I think they did a press conference in the middle of Michigan Avenue after one of their sessions, seriously, and they stopped traffic. And they were welcomed with open arms, which is what this film is about. You know, I mean, Muddy and Willie Dixon, they hung out at the sessions hoping that the Stones would record their stuff. You know, there was that kind of respect and love. And the same thing happened in the clubs. These black guys, when the white kids started playing, they weren't that great. But the guys realized the reverence they had for it and the love for they had for it, and they waited for them to get good. And amazingly, John, they all became great. You know, all 12 of them became virtuosos on their instrument. I mean, it wouldn't have been the same if they had just kind of wandered off into club bands or whatever. But they, you know, had the not only the guts to show up, but they had the stick with itness to practice like you needed to get good.
Well, they were dedicated and they were talented at the same time. And that's
what the black guys recognized. And
yeah,
that was,
absolutely.
You know, and they became, you know, I think Barry babysat for Otis Spann's kids. And I think Bloomfield babysat for Muddy's kids. And, you know, I've come to know some of their offspring. And of course, in the process of making the film, I've gotten to meet all of the principals that are still alive. And it's just been so amazing for me as a music fan to be, you know, to know a little bit about the inside of the story. And, you know, I hope it comes through in the film.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it. And I'm listening to you talk about not only this particular project, but your previous projects and your just general knowledge of how the blues circulates still around Chicago and how it circulated then. I'm pretty sure this is going to be a very successful venture for you. What happens to this documentary after this screening? What about availability to the public? What about on a streaming service? You know, where does it go from here? So does, pardon me?
This is when the music really gets upbeat. But yes, the good news is that I can announce that Shout Factory is releasing it worldwide on August 1st, which means that it will be available on all of the streaming services, except for Netflix probably at first, you know, as of August 1st. So people will be able to find it. And I must say, based upon the viewings that we've had of the other blues films that I've worked on, it's a good time. You know, people are really interested in this stuff.
Oh, absolutely. Congratulations on that. And don't worry about Netflix. I mean, there are so many other streaming platforms. I'm sure that Born in Chicago will find its place. Once again, the film is called Born in Chicago. It's a blues documentary. Full-length documentary on Chicago blues, and it's going to be screened. Where's that screening again going to occur?
It's at the Claudia Cassidy Theater at the Chicago Cultural Center. And can I just bring up one more topic, John?
You can go. You can take the entire half hour for all I care. Go ahead.
Okay. it's something that it's important to deal with. I just wanted to bring it up, which is the concept that sometimes comes up of cultural appropriation.
Oh, yeah.
And I wish I had my co-filmmaker, Bob Sarles, here, or Joel Selman, because they've said this before very eloquently. But, you know, cultural appropriation suggests that something was stolen. And it not only suggests that, it suggests that it was done without purpose or without, you know, without any concern for the originator. That's not the case here. This music was a gift. It was a gift from these guys. And I've got them saying it on film in their own words to these white guys. They developed a love for each other. But more than that, they realized that these were kids who might be able to spread the word of their what they loved. So they weren't innocent, these black guys. They saw that. And in fact, it came around. The other side of cultural appropriation is kind of debunked by the concept that as soon as these guys had any sway in the business, they turned the attention back on their mentors. They in the San Francisco scene was run by Bill Graham. Butterfield and Bloomfield made sure that Bill had to book the original guys in his places, and they took a chance on the young people liking it, and they did. And, you know, Chicago did its own thing. In 69, in August, Gravenitis and others organized a giant event, a concert called Fathers and Sons at the Auditorium Theater. A sellout. Marshall Chess says in the film, these were all the kids that had shown up at all the blues clubs on the north and mainly the north side since these guys had come along a few years earlier, just kind of cutting loose. And there's a beautiful document of it on LP. And to this day, it's Muddy Waters' biggest selling record.
That's amazing. And well said, by the way, John. I appreciate that. I think it's a very important point that you make there. I never really even gave it a thought that someone might think that the white kids were quote unquote stealing it. I know when I like something, I like it regardless of where it comes from. And if I'm going to incorporate it in anything, if I were a musician, I certainly wouldn't have the thought running through my mind that I was stealing something. I never thought of that at all. I just thought it was one sort of ever expanding blues family, so to speak, you know, passing it on to another generation, if you will. Don't you think so?
Yes, I do. The question does come up of people who don't really know the story. And, you know, I really think that it comes through thanks to Bob's work and mine. Uh-huh. I think it comes through in the film.
Well, John, thank you so much for being with us. And what's that date that it starts streaming?
Start streaming August 1st, and I got to tell you, I listened to you religiously on Wibbage in Philadelphia.
Oh, no! What were you doing there? Wait a minute.
I was going to high school. I had to go to high school. I couldn't get out of it.
And what high school?
We were on Wibbage, and
what high
was,
school?
You know, it was so much fun, wasn't it? They were the wild days of radio.
What high school did you go to?
I went to Plymouth White Marsh.
Oh, my God.
I went to an event that you did.
Oh, geez.
Maybe a roller rink? Is that possible?
Oh, sure, it's possible.
Okay, and I'm not saying this to butter you up, okay? We already did the interview, but what struck me seriously was that you were young, okay?
Oh, yeah.
Joe Niagara was old, okay? Yes. High Lit looked good, but he was old. Jerry Blavitt was ancient, and you looked like you were in your 20s.
Well, that's because I was like 21 years old. That's why. Yeah.
Okay.
We're talking about a radio station in Philadelphia, and John just reeled off some really big, iconic radio names in Philadelphia radio history. wow. Well, on that note, which was totally unexpected, I did not see that coming. Thanks again, John, and I'm looking forward to seeing the movie. Thank you. Good
thanks
talking
for
to
the
you.
Support, John.